So, no matter who you are, no matter where you are in your spiritual journey, you are celebrated here. So, again, for those of you who are new or first time, we begin with a little bit of silence. May grace be in our heads and in our thinking. May grace be in our eyes and in our seeing. May grace be in our ears and in our hearing. May grace be in my mouth and in my speaking. May grace be in our hearts and in our understanding. And may grace be at our ends and at our departing. One of the joys of my life, up until the time the pandemic, which forever changed so many things, was playing racquetball. Really. Unless I was sick or out of town, I played racquetball for at least once, maybe twice a week for decades. And I got to be fairly good at it, actually. You know, Yogi Berra says that if it's the truth, it's not bragging. Now, in order to play racquetball, there are certain things you need. You need the proper equipment. You need shoes, of course. You need shorts and shirt. You need eye protection. That's critically important in playing racquetball because you can get hit in the face. You need a racket. You need gloves so it doesn't slip out of your hand. And you need racquetballs. And more importantly, you need two other things. You need a place to play, and you need someone to play with. And someone has got to make the arrangements to play on a weekly basis. Got to call, reserve the court, do that sort of thing. And you have to know the rules of racquetball. Some of the rules are unwritten. Many of the rules came from squash, because squash predates racquetball. Squash, I think, originated maybe in India. The Indians produced the best squash and racquetball players. If you're not committed to paying attention, I hope you can begin to get the parallels here. If you are not committed to paying attention in the racquetball court, you stand the chance of getting injured. I mean, seriously. And you have to demonstrate the kind of attitude that would cause somebody to want to play with you again. Right? My experience is that really good racquetball players take delight in another racquetball player's great shot. You know, man, that was a good kill shot. Wow, that was great. Even if he best you on that particular shot. Racquetball is a great game to play. I miss it. I would take it up again, but at my age, my fear of falling, and you can take serious falls playing racquetball, keeps me off the court. You and I are playing a game right now. And I would like for us to be more aware of that. Because mindfulness is a key component in doing spiritual work. Last week, I ended talking about the fact that as a teacher, and these are the words of Richard Rohr, Jesus was the first non-dual teacher in the West. Now, if we're going to understand Jesus and his teachings, we have to be open to understanding insofar as it is possible. We have to understand non-duality. And this is a challenge because trying to do this is something we do with dualistically trained minds in a dualistic culture with dualistic language. So it is a challenge to do. So I thought that maybe perhaps talking about the games that we play, like the one that we are playing right now, might open the door to understanding more about non-duality. So last week I summed up both Jesus and his teaching of non-duality by saying there is no other. That's non-duality in a nutshell. We don't live in the culture that promotes this because we like to other people. So we're playing a game right now. The game is called Ordinary Life. There are rules. Most of them are not written down. One of the few written ones is that the teacher begins teaching sometime close to 10 o'clock and quit sometime up around 10:45. The game we're playing is an educational game in nature that deals with religious and spiritual matters, usually with some reference to Christianity and Jesus, not all the time. This is a lecture type game. There are other games in this category that are not lecture games. There are discussion games, there are book study games, there are seminar type games. One analogy might be that they're like football, baseball, soccer, hockey are all sports, but they're different in the same genre, okay? So this is just one type of religious spiritual game that could be played. Most of the games that we play have rules, and these rules come from what psychologists call conventionality. For example, we would not wear a swimming suit to this gathering because convention says that's not something you do. But rules like these change. It used to be that people would go to the Houston Symphony dressed in their Sunday finest, but no longer. Rules change. It used to be that if you went flying on an airplane, you put on a suit and tie, but now you wear your pajamas. Seriously? Laws change to fit the culture. We watched a documentary movie about the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she successfully argued cases before the Supreme Court about gender discrimination because culture made the rules change. Okay. Now, when this game that we call Ordinary Life is over, we'll go play other games. Some people go to play the Life Ordinary Life discussion group game. Some people go to play the Sunday brunch game. Some go to play the Sunday afternoon nap game. Some combine the 11 o'clock worship game with the nap game. There are some people who use Sunday to make yourself miserable because Sunday is the most It's the greatest day to make yourself miserable. I learned this from Dan Greenwood's book, How to Make Yourself Miserable, King. Now, last week I said that in response to being asked, if he was religious, Jesus, being a devout Jew, would say that what mattered was that you love God with all that you are and that you love your neighbor as yourself. The first part is part of a daily prayer that Jews prayed every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And the second part is from a line that Jesus got from what we call the book of Deuteronomy. Now, dualistic minds hear those two things from Jesus and immediately want to figure out, well, who is God and who's my neighbor? That's how dualism thinks. Well, Jesus answered those questions by saying, there is no other. Now, to grasp this teaching, we have to be willing to enter non-duality, or in the spiritual word for non-duality is mysticism. So non-duality does not come from reading, research, or academic discourse. That's very important. But it comes after doing all of that from someplace else. And those of you who are meditators know what I am talking about. Whatever form of meditation you assume, whether it's sitting, walking, lectio of some kind, lectio divina, lectio visual, like going to the art museum, or active imagination, centering prayer. You know what it's like simply to allow yourselves to be carried by the sacred stream, and you know how liberating it is to be freed, however briefly, from the bondage of the ego. Now, we all assume roles in these dramas that we play, these games. For example, right now, I am playing the role of the teacher. And you are playing the role of the listener. But even this gets very confusing. Because you see, in order to be here, I'm the one who learns the most. So I am the student and then you are the teacher. It gets complicated. Now tomorrow morning we will get up and we will play other games. Some will play I'm going to work game. Some will play I'm a retired game. Some will play I'm a volunteer game. Some of us combine the games that we play on Monday with other games that we play simultaneously, like I'm at work and I'm also married game. Or I'm at work and I'm also a parent game. So we play these games simultaneously. For some, the married game or relationship game is like a sitcom. And for others, it has overtones of murder. Now, these roles that we play in these games that we are playing, we can get out of like that. Those of you who play We Are a Family game or I'm in a Relationship game know what the truth of what I just said by an experience I'm going to describe that I wager 95% of the people in this room have had. You are in a heated exchange with someone you are playing your particular game with. You're in the parent game. And you're shouting at a child. Or you're in a relationship game and you are at the height of a snit, wondering why in the world I'm with this doofus in the first place, right? And the phone rings. And you pick it up and you immediately play the most congenial person in the world game. You're about to say, you lousy, hello there. They're roles we play. Now, my point is that all these things we do are games. Sometimes I play the role of a therapist. I promise you, it is not a role that is appreciated in my marriage. That's a whole different game. And I'm not saying the games are not meaningful. They are. And we should play them well. The rules are important. And we should play the game with wisdom and understanding and skillfully. The problem comes when we start thinking that the game we play or the role we're playing in the game we're playing is real. That this is what really matters. Or this is who I really am. We all have that part that we can put on stage at a moment's notice. It's just who I am. I would remind you that identifying with any part or role we play in the game of life is a trap. Why is that? Because nothing lasts. Nothing lasts. So when I say to you, this is not really me up here speaking to you. That's not really you who is listening to this. Rather, these are parts we are playing in the particular game that we have agreed for this particular amount of time to play together. Okay? Now, if you have problems with what I'm saying or you resist it, man, I understand that. When the spiritual director I learned this from taught it to me back in the 60s, I yes-butted him for weeks. Yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. I'm sorry to tell you this, but if your favorite line in a heated discussion that you are having with somebody ends up saying, well, you just have to accept me as I am. This is who I am. That's a line. It's a role you've learned to play, and it's no more or less true than any other role or line you say in any other game that you are playing. Okay? I rather stubbornly refused to embrace this until years later I heard Robert Johnson say in teaching about the difference between ego and self, that we needed to have a strong ego, not an inflated one, not a diminished one, but a strong ego, so that we could be in the various worlds we are in without either gaining or losing our identity in the roles that we play. You follow what I'm saying? Now, this greatly helped me understand the teaching of Jesus. You must learn to be in the world, but not of the world. The way I was taught what this teaching meant was that you should not let the evil, bad world taint you with its gone wrong ways, which is not what Jesus meant at all. For Jesus, it meant you are who you are in the heart of sacred mystery. No more, no less. This is our real identity. And this is the game that we are playing. And right now, the purpose of this talk today is to equip us to be more aware of the game we're playing and better equipped to play it. Now, we've all known persons. We've been capable of being those people ourselves who have been so invested in, say, what they did for a living that when that was no longer what they were able to do, they had no identity. They were gone. We've all known people who were so invested in the intimate relationship that they were in that when it came to an end, as all relationships do, they were lost. They stopped living. Nothing less. Don't blame me for that. When you take up a daily spirit, the same thing I'm saying applies to ideas and beliefs. When you take up a daily spiritual practice that involves meditation, you will quickly learn that the mind has a mind of its own. The job of the mind is to have thoughts. And it does, independent of what we try to make the mind do. It just has thoughts. And the meditation teachers say that we should relate to our thoughts and beliefs like we relate to the leaves on a stream, you know, the sacred stream. Have I brought that up? Yeah. Like the leaves on a stream that are flowing down, and we just notice them, and we notice them. Thought after thought passes in front of us. That's a thought, that's a thought, that's a thought. That becomes a problem because we will see one thought and we'll say, ah, that's real. And we'll jump in the water and grab a hold to it and down we go or off to the ocean. I just love this cartoon. I don't know if you can read what it says. My stone, I don't want to give up my stone. It's not much, but it's mine. I can't live without my stone. On the other hand, hanging on to that stone is going to kill me. There's not a person in this room who doesn't know what it's like to be captured this way. When I started in training in Jungian analysis, then my analyst tried to teach me about Jung's concept of complexes, and he said that we have complexes. No. Complexes have us. You know it. Out of the blue, something reaches up from down below and grabs you, and boy, you're in that snit. Right? If you remember, I went through a period of talks in here this year talking about Jim Marion's book, The Death of the Mythic God. He talks a lot about non-duality in the book, and I just want to go very quickly through his levels of developmental consciousness. Now, this is one of a multitude of models that's out there, but in preparation for the game that we're about to play. We're playing a game within a game in a minute. You need to be reacquainted with this. The first level in consciousness is what Marion calls archaic consciousness. This begins with the infant's differentiation of its own body from the mother. So we're born in this wholeness, but then reality impedes and separates us from that original unity, and the child is rejected from paradise. It's the beginning of the myth in all creation stories, the separation. And then there's magical consciousness. This usually happens when a person is between 2 and 7 years of age. This is where all tribal cultures live. We're getting close to that in this culture. And then there is mythic consciousness. This usually lasts till we're about 14, 15. This is the conformist stage, want to be liked and in the group and accepted. This is where Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Sky God live, because these things can rearrange our world, they can work miracles, and if necessary, punish our enemies. It's amazing to me how all these hero myths are coming back in our culture now. People who are stuck at this level religiously see other religions as evil or heretics or just wrong. And this is where all monotheistic religions are stuck at this level right here. And there's a rational conscious level. To get here requires some work and willingness to die to former worldviews and have the realization, gee, the only reason that we are talking like this, playing this game, is because we are here and not there. Comprende? Because we're here in this culture and not in Indian culture, not in Japanese culture, not in African culture. We're having this conversation. But if we were in one of those cultures, we would have a similar conversation with just as much meaning. Okay? Now, people who like to hang on to the truth, this is scary. But it gets better. There's a vision logic level. People are more grounded in themselves. This is what we call global consciousness, where race, skin color, gender, sexual orientation, national origin, they don't concern. As a matter of fact, people delight in diversity at vision logic level. Wow, we're multicultural. That's wonderful. And then there's the psychic consciousness level. This is what the mystics refer to as the awakened self. Jim Finley refers to this level as mystical knowing. And then in this model, because Marion is a Christian, writing from a Christian mindset. There's what he calls Christ consciousness, which doesn't have anything really to do with Jesus, but Jesus is involved in it. This is where Meister Eckhart lived and wrote. Meister Eckhart said, "God, rid me of God." Or Meister Eckhart could pray, "The eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me." That's that level. Okay. Now, I don't know where you are on this model. We can be all over the place. I hope that most of us are at vision logic level, but we have a tendency to think higher of ourselves than we should. Just a fact. Like, most of us think we're above average drivers. And that ain't the case. Most of what is dividing this country right now is at this level. A mythic consciousness level. And non-duality that I'm trying to teach about today is at this level. Okay. Now, up until the time that the Jesus movement became a belief system, and Jesus got reduced to a comma, Jesus was not considered an exception to humanity, but the identity of every person who tries to make the journey in love. One's relationship with Jesus did not keep that person out of hell, but rather empowered that person to create what he called the kingdom of God or heaven on earth. I think we're only just beginning to try to understand this. Now, I'm going to risk attempting non-dual speak. I'm going to do a riff on a teaching I first heard from Jim Finley. This is in a conference called Following the Mystics Through the Narrow Gate, which I think you can still get CDs of on, I doubt they make CDs anymore, do they? You can stream it. You can download it. You can download it from Richard Rohr's website. It's a seminar that Jim Finley did. And in that seminar, Jim Finley said, "I am not God, but I am not other than God either." Now, there were people at this conference who had trouble with this, because if God is at the level of the mythic God and is out there, then this is problematic. That this is non-dual speak. Finley went on to say, "I am not you, but I am not other than you either." So the title of the conference, Following the Mystics Through the Narrow Gate. The Narrow Gate is a reference to a teaching that Jesus offers near the end of one of the Jesus narratives. I think it's Matthew, where Jesus is quoted as saying, there are two ways to go. One is broad and spacious. It's easy. A lot of people are on it. And the other straight and narrow, and few choose it. You're familiar with that particular Jesus. So that's where Finley, in the context in which Finley said this talk. So again, just to reprise, if you ask Jesus, "Are you religious?" he would say two things: love God and love your neighbor. Now, one other thing before we go into the game. What I'm about to say is a mystery, and yes, a mystery. Dualistic thinking says a mystery is not understandable. Non-dual thinking says that a mystery is endlessly understandable. There's a difference between those. So what I'm trying to do, and I'll bring up John Caputo next week, is to try to find the religion within the religion that Christianity says that it is. For example, when I say to you that Jesus is the light of the world, I am not trying to get you to look at Jesus. I'm trying to get you to see by the light of Jesus. We don't look at the light. We see by the light. We use the light to get around. And what seeing is what gives meaning. I'm not saying that what we believe doesn't matter. It does. But I'm more interested in why people believe what they say they believe. What are the underlying assumptions about others and ourselves that shape the beliefs that we have? It seems to me that in this country, we suffer from a cultural conspiracy that leads us to lack common sense. And what I mean by common sense is that we separate ourselves from each other so that we don't find a way that is common for all of us. Common. Like the Book of Common Prayer for everybody sense. So I want to tell you a bedtime story. This is a game. Don't go to sleep. It is one that I created, I could just quote my sources fairly. I started working on this back in the 60s with a reading of Alan Watts, and some of you may know, philosophical entertainer is what he called himself. Brilliant mind, hopeless alcoholic, but just brilliant. And the works of Jim Finley and Meister Eckhart and a couple of others. You ready? I don't think you've heard something like this before. Now, this story does not begin once upon a time because there was never a time when things weren't. Just like a circle doesn't have a beginning or an end, or the hands of a watch go up and down 12, 6, day and night follow each other, waking and sleeping, living and dying, summer, winter. What does the song say? You can't have one without the other. You know, black, white, the whole shebang, yin yang. So there have been times when the world as we think we know it, and we are just learning more and more about the way the world is, there have been times when the world as we think we know it has been, and there have been times when the world as we think we know it has not been. If things went on and on and on without rest, it'd just be boring. So it's like a good magic effect that I have done in here a couple weeks ago, where now you see the half a dollars and now you don't. That's the game. It's like your breath. You can't hold it, you'll die. It comes and goes. That's why meditators use breath to focus on for people. It's like a game of hide and seek that you play. If the game of hide and seek is going to work, you have to continually find new places to hide or the game is no fun. Now, the mystery that we call God loves to play hide and seek. But this is where non-dual mind is so critical. Because there is nothing that is not God. God has no one to play this game with but himself. And the way that God gets over this is by pretending not to be himself. Now, I am referring to God as he, though you know as well as I do that God is not a man or a woman. God is not a Republican. God is not a Democrat. And though I love the mind and work of Paul Tillich, I quarrel with his calling God the ground of being. That's way too impersonal. Besides, when you think of something as an it, it doesn't sound alive. And God is alive, very, very alive. So back to the game. We're playing a game, remember? So the way that God plays hide and seek is by pretending not to be himself. You know who he pretends to be? You and me and everyone else. There's no them. And everything else and every living creature, the whole shebang, all the stars, the galaxies, the planets, everything. In this way, God has all these strange, wonderful adventures, some of which are terrible and frightening, but really, these are just like bad dreams, which we sometimes have, because when God wakes up, yes, he naps from time to time, they disappear. God is so good at playing this game, at pretending to be you and me, that sometimes it takes him a long time, just like it does us, to remember where he put his car keys. That's how good he is at playing this game. I mean, if he found stuff too quickly, what would be the fun in that? There's no tension. There's no mystery. And that's why it's so hard sometimes for you and me to discover that we are God in disguise, pretending not to be God. Now, the goal of a class like this is for us to wake up, stop pretending, and to remember that we are all one single, not them, self, God. The whole shebang. Now, there are some parts of God that seem to catch on to this quicker than earlier parts of God. We call those saints. And I'm going to devote a particular block of time to this next week. These mystics, these spiritual guides, these enlightened ones. Sometimes they're called crazy. Seriously. And sometimes, often they're called heretics. Because they can be so easily misunderstood. But this is exactly what Finley was manifesting when he said, I'm not God, I'm not other than God. I'm not you, I'm not other than you. And there were, I promise you, people in that crowd who went, no. They didn't like that because they're not at the level. You got to watch it. This can lead to inflation where they get it. That this is a game where there's no them. Now, you and I have skins and bodies so that we will know that in some ways we are different from each other. God doesn't have a skin or body or shape or any inside or outside. God is more like a Mobius strip. There's no beginning or end. And you can't see God directly. For the same reason you can't see yourself directly. You can stand in a mirror and see a reflection of yourself. You can stand in some places and see reflections of God. Like look at your partner. Oh God. I know that you thought in her or in him. This is part of the narrow way. This is God being so good at hiding. And you might say, and I don't blame you, it sounds interesting, but what about the suffering in the world? What about the suffering in my life? Why does God hide in the form of horrible people? Why does God pretend to be people who suffer great disease or pain or to be victims of warfare? We saw a movie last night called Wonder. Have you seen it? about a boy who was born with a horribly disfigured face and after 15 surgeries tried to find his way in the world. You wonder why, and there was a great healing in that movie. I recommend it. There is nothing that even God could say that would cause any one of us, in the face of some catastrophic diagnosis or loss, for us to say, oh, well, that makes sense. Because part of what we do, playing the game that we play, is to suffer our attachments. When Buddha said that we suffer because of attachment, he was just describing reality. He was not saying don't have attachment. Attachment is inevitable. Now, because we are so steeped in dualistic thinking, we forget that God is only doing this to himself. And further, keep in mind that from the beginning of our creating stories, we ourselves have enjoyed those stories most, where there are witches and ogres and bad guys. We love the thrill of a story and can't wait to see how it turns out. And if I listen to Jesus really carefully, what he says is, it's going to be okay. Now, if I'm making this sound too unrealistic, hang out with somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh for a while. He's the Buddhist monk exiled from Vietnam because he wouldn't take sides. Their order would not take sides. And I met him in a conference. This is not my notes, but I will tell you, I told this story before. It was such a brilliant thing. It's a conference that Thich Nhat Hanh was doing on the practice of mindfulness and psychotherapy, and this woman from California, yes, that's a judgment, but it was how she dressed and talked that made me say that. Asked Thich Nhat Hanh, how do you suggest that we deal with our patients with anger? And Thich Nhat Hanh had anger is a big problem for Buddhists, although he wrote a big thick book on anger. And Thich Nhat Hanh couldn't get it, and finally he asked this woman, he said, how do you get your patients to deal with anger now? And she said, well, we give them put a pillow in front of them and give them a big bat called a bataka, and we tell them to beat the pillow until they get all their anger out. What do you think about that? And Thich Nhat Hanh got right down in her face and took his finger and said, I think you better talk to pillow. There's no them. He's the one who said there's no peace, there's no way to peace. Peace is the way to be. And after 9/11, he was asked, how would you respond to what just happened? And he said that he would get all the parties involved in a room together, and after a long period of silence, he would ask those who were the recipients of the 9/11 attack to ask those who were the perpetrators of the attack, why are you so angry with us? And just listen. Think what a different world we would be living in had we done something like that instead of going off on revenge and retaliation, looking for weapons of mass destruction that never existed. Now you can say, well, when you were playing the game of ordinary life this morning, what did Bill do? And he said, well, he told a story. Just a story. You could do that. Jesus told stories. And I cannot find that any of his even harshest critics said about the stories he told, even the ones that got him executed, that's just a story. But today, we live in such a dualistic culture where other stories about the origin things, the creation of the earth, the color of your skin, your gender orientation, are to be taken as tests of belief. There are some people who are academically smart in so many areas who are absolutely stupid in others. Irrevocable commitment to any religion is intellectual suicide. Why? Because it reflects a lack of faith that closes the mind to any new vision of the world. Alan Watts, one of the people whose writings influenced the story I just told you, said, "No considerate God would destroy the human mind by making it so rigid and unadaptable as to depend on one book, the Bible, for all the answers." I spend a considerable amount of my time, much to the chagrin of a number of people who are sitting in this very room, a number of years ago, going through the sayings of Jesus called the Gospel of Thomas. And it's incorrect to call it a gospel because it isn't a story. We have gospels like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And there are others that we didn't make into the New Testament canon that are stories, they're narratives. Jesus gets born, he has a life, he teaches, he dies, and that's it. But the Gospel of Thomas is not that. It's a collection of sayings. And my studies indicate me to believe that the sayings in the Gospel of Thomas, which, by the way, you can download for free off the internet, is that the sayings in the Gospel of Thomas predate the sayings that we have in any of the Gospels. Most, two-thirds of the sayings in the Gospel of Thomas are found in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. Not so much in John, but they are there. Here's one of the sayings in Thomas. When you make the two one, and when you make the inner as the outer, and the outer is the inner, and the above is the below, then you shall enter the kingdom. I am the light that is above them all. Now, it's this light that I'm inviting you to use to see by, not to believe in, not to create a doctrine about, but to use as guidance, especially to see yourself, and especially when you have the courage to see anything you put the label other on, anything that you call them. No matter where you go this week, no matter what happens, you carry, remember this, you carry precious cargo, so watch your step. Hope to see you here next week. Thank you.